I'm Brennan Mejia, and I play Tyler, the Red Dino Charge Ranger, and you're listening to the Lightning Collective podcast, hosted by Callum. It's about to get wild!
Hello and welcome to the 1 year anniversary of the Lightning Collective podcast. I'm your host Callum, and today I'm not only discussing the recently released comic book Power Rangers Unlimited Edge of Darkness, but like always, I'm going through the career of the author, that being Frank Gogol, who is joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, so am I. I'm really excited. As always, before we get onto the subject, let's talk news.
Super 7 have revealed their first wave of Power Rangers Ultimates line, and that is the Yellow Ranger, Green Ranger, Goldar, the Putty Patroller, as well as the Tyrannosaurus Dinozord. I will probably go more into detail with these in an upcoming episode, but if you follow me on socials, you know that it's not really my cup of tea, per se. I mean, if you love them, you love them. I'm not going to take that away from you. You go ahead. It's just the price point is a bit rough for what you get. Usually with the Ultimates line, it's very retro-looking. It calls back to previous toy lines. I don't feel like this does so with Power Rangers. It is what it is, unfortunately. There was a Fan First Friday, literally today, and there's a lot of news to go through. So the first thing is that Hasbro teamed up with Reebok to bring six pairs of trainers to the market. Five of them are Ranger themed, the core five, of course, and then the sixth one is like a Megazord homage. I quite like the Megazord homage, although I don't like the shoe that the paint scheme's on, or whatever you want to call it, the deco, whatever. I do like the yellow Ranger shoes the most. I think they look really nice. Next up is the Lightning Collection line. So Wave 10 is finally announced. So it's Zeo Yellow, In Space Pink, Phantom Ranger from In Space, which is bizarre, but it is what it is. And also Riley, the Green Dino Charge Ranger. I think that's a great wave, personally. I will go more into detail again in a future episode. There's also news on the Power Rangers Dino Fury basic line as well, and that is that Gold as well as Void Knight will be in a wave of their own, and Black and Green will be in a five pack, an Amazon exclusive, with the rest of the team with their swords. I can't remember the name. What is their swords called? Is it just called Chroma Fury Saber? Is that what it's called? You get what I mean, though. They'll come with those weapons as well, which is pretty good, but I understand that people are completely miffed that the only way that you can get Black and Green is 3S 5 pack. It's a bit of a con, I'm not gonna lie, but it will be nice for everyone like me who didn't get the first three figures. But I completely get the hate on that one. And they also showed off the gold Megazord as well, the Plesiosaur, I think that's what it's called. But yeah, the Gold Zord for the main line, that's going to be in Wave 2. They showed a grayscale version of it, and they also revealed a few details about when the Zords are releasing, and it will be late summer, early fall. So we can look forward to that. They also showed off the packaging, which again, I'll talk about in future. I think all of the reveals for that day were really good. Also, another bit of news for games. Mighty Morphin Yellow Ranger in Black Dragon armor, it has released on the Battle for the Grid game. So you can go download that now, I believe. That's it for news. I did go through it pretty quickly just because there was a lot of news, and I plan on doing a future episode just talking about that news. It was all very exciting, and I've got a lot of thoughts. And also, I do apologize because the quality of this interview goes downhill. Not what I ask, but just my mic quality. So thankfully, Frank did all of the heavy lifting, and I only talk for like a minute at a time. But yeah, I do apologize about my mic quality. I was not aware when I was recording. And for a future episode, my mic quality is also a bit iffy because I recorded two back to back, which is a bit... I'm sorry about that. I will try and fix the second episode, which comes out in 2 weeks, as best as I can.
I believe that's it for news. If I've missed anything, hit me up at Lightning Collection on Instagram or PRL Collective on Twitter. Let's get straight onto the interview. You've been a part of the comics industry since 2018, your first piece of work being Grief, that was self-funded. The book was a nominee for Best Anthology at the Ringo Awards in 2019. Why did you pick 2018 to be the year you entered the industry?
You know, I actually didn't choose it. It chose me, I guess you could say. But the truth is, I got started writing comics back in 2016. The short version of it is I was at a job that I didn't like very much, that I was good at, it paid well, but it wasn't fulfilling. And my then girlfriend, who is now my wife, you know, she noticed and she brought it up with me one night. And yeah, it was a long conversation that ended with her asking me what I wanted to be doing with my life. And I said, yeah, I want to write comics. Like, this is what I'm passionate about. And this was toward the end of 2015. And she said, well, you know, what would you need to be doing to make that happen? Like, what does the roadmap look like? And I said, and, you know, I was just putting it out there. Like, I didn't expect anything to come of it. I didn't have any kind of motives behind saying it. I just gave her an honest answer. And I said, you know, if I could take 1 year of my life and just sit down and focus on comics, figuring out how to write, getting my discipline in order, making connections and networking and all those things, if I had 1 year, I think I could do this. And she said, so do it. There were some financial conversations after that about making sure that we would be able to pay our bills and whatnot. I took the year of 2016 off from a full-time day job, and every day from 7 to 5 or 7 to 7 is at my desk writing and learning and taking classes and traveling to conventions and networking and putting all the those pieces into place to start the ball rolling on a comics career. And during that first year, I wrote Grief. It's a short story collection. I wrote the 10 short stories in it between April of 2016 and December of 2016. They were never meant to be a collection. They were just kind of my practice for writing. I wanted to see if I could write a horror story. I wanted to see if I could write a sci-fi story. I wanted to see if I could write something and run it through the production of making a comic, finding an artist, getting it colored, getting it lettered, getting it ready for print. Like that 2016 was like a giant sandbox for me to learn comics and put that learning into practice. So that, you know, all that work led to me developing Grief as a concept book, I guess. In 2017, the following April, it ran on Kickstarter as a digital-only book, and it was funded very quickly. It ended up being funded several times over, and the support for the book was incredible. You know, to this day, I still wake up and am very thankful that campaign was the success that it was. And then 1 year later from that, Grief was released in print. Sourcepoint Press, my current creator-owned publisher, who have put out all my books that are, you know, books that I own, they picked up the book in October of 2017. I met with them at New York Comic Con and had that conversation, and it came out the following April in 2018. So it was a longer road than it just coming out in April of 2018. But yeah, that's the short version of it, I guess. It's not so short.
What resources did you pull from in order to network and really, well, build this web that you could pull from for this book and for future books, actually, as well?
Sure. So the first thing I did, and this was something that was on my radar for a long time, and I kind of never pulled the trigger, but decided this is where I would start, was I enrolled in the intro to comic book writing class that Comics Experience offers. Comics Experience is an online comic school. They do art and coloring and lettering and editing and project management classes, like, you know, soup to nuts, top to bottom, the whole spectrum of making a comic book can be learned through these courses. It's run by a guy named Andy Schmidt, who was an editor at Marvel. He edited books like Annihilation, the Ed Brubaker Captain America run. He was involved with Civil War. So this, you know, this was a guy who knew his stuff and was passionate about teaching. So he started a comic school, and he did it online because he wanted to be able to reach the broadest audience. And I got involved with that at the suggestion of a friend who had done it a few years prior. And in joining that, there is a forum aspect to it where there is a group of people who I would consider my peers at the time, you know, other people who are trying to get started or up and coming, and also some folks who are considered pros. I think at the time, if I'm remembering correctly, who was on there? Andy was on there, obviously. Riley Brown, who's a Marvel artist, got a handful of other people. And then at the same time as me, people like Ram V, who's doing big things at Marvel and DC now, were on there. Nick Spencer was on there. Colin Bunn. It was a really, really positive place, full of talent and people who are like-minded. And being on those forums allowed me to make connections with people, like I said, who are, you know, kind of batting at the same level as me and who were already learning the ropes of comics and out there doing it at places like Marvel and DC and Boom. And so that let me have access to people whose brains I could pick. You know, if I had a question about print production, I could reach out to somebody who knew more about it than I did. And that really streamlined a lot of it. One of the things that is great about being a comics creator in, you know, the 2020s is that the internet exists and that the knowledge is a lot more accessible than it was, you know, and if you wanted to be a comics creator back in the 80s, you had to figure it all out because you couldn't just ask somebody, you know, who lived on the other side of the world who knew. So like I, you know, kind of came in at an advantage and then had this incredible resource in the Comics Experience forums. In addition to that, I did a little bit of traveling. I went to some conventions, some of the bigger ones. I mentioned New York Comic Con. I also went to C2E2 in Chicago. I think I went down to Houston for the Comic Palooza down there. And you know, I went down there or to all these shows with the mindset that it was a business trip. It wasn't for pleasure. I wasn't there to dig through long boxes. I was there to meet peers and publishers and build out, you know, my quote unquote Rolodex you know, I took it really seriously. My publisher now, Sourcepoint Press, I met them at one of those shows for the first time and fostered that relationship. I also met my first contacts at Boom Studios at one of those shows. I can't remember which one. I want to say it was C2E2, which was the first step to, you know, down that long road that eventually led to me getting a shot at a Power Rangers book, I'm sure. So it's just, you know, the networking of it all was a huge focus for me in 2016 and continues to be until this day. Just, you know, you are only as relevant as who you know, because, you know, you can't open all the doors yourself. Somebody needs to help open the doors for you.
I feel like a lot of creative industries, not just comic books, but TV and film, it is who you know, and you need to have those skills in networking, otherwise you're not going to get very far. It doesn't really, I mean, it of course matters about your skill level, but I just mean in terms of you could be the best at something in the world, but it's really who you meet and what they decide, or what they decide what doors to open for you, that really push you forward. But it's good that you found a really rich resource that you could pull from pretty much constantly that got you where you felt like you needed to be. When Grief was nominated, was that a shock to you, or were you happy? What was the feeling that was going through your mind at that point?
You know, so Grief is a strange little book. Like, anthologies are not a popular format. I think Grief has a leg up on most anthologies because it's got one writer, which, like, I would categorize it more as a short story collection than an anthology just because of that aspect. But that's kind of splitting hairs. It is a strange little book because it is a short story format, which in the American comics industry is not the most beloved format. It's by an unknown quantity. Like, when I released it, nobody knew who I was. It deals with really, really, really heavy topics. I would say that it is a character-focused book more than a genre-focused book. These are stories about real people going through things, you know, and then there are aliens and monsters in the mix too, but it's really just very heavy emotional content. I remember when the book debuted in print in 2018, it was at the C2E2 in Chicago. It was my first convention ever. I had never hand sold a comic before. I was meeting a whole lot of new people. It was a really intense experience, and it was a 4-day show. And when I got there, I had a sit down with Travis McIntyre, who's the editor in chief at Source Point Press. And I said to him, look, I've never done this before. I don't know how good I'll be at it. You know, like I want this book to sell well and perform well for you guys, but like, I don't know if that's in my skill set. I don't know if this is what people are looking for. And we had a conversation and we talked about it, and he said, you know, look, it's 4 days. Let's see if we can move 20 copies by the end of the weekend. Like we've got a couple hundred with us. You know, let's see if we can move 20. That's 5 a day, right? Less than 1 per hour. And I was like, that seems reasonable. And you know, it's fine. And we ended up selling 60 in the first day. That was when I was like, okay, this there's something going on with this book. It's speaking to people. So by the time the Ringo nomination rolled around, which was almost a year later, because the Ringos are offset by a year. So the 2019 Ringos look at books released in 2018. By the time the nomination rolled around, I understood that, you know, this was a special book that was connecting with people, but I was still surprised by the nomination. It kind of came out of nowhere. The Ringos are a fairly young award show, but I'd still say they're in the top three award shows with the Eisners and the Harveys in comics. So yeah, it was surprising. It definitely took me, you know, it knocked the wind out of me when I heard, and I was excited. And it was very cool. Like it was a really cool acknowledgement early on in my career that kind of just let me know that I was on the right path. Let me know that I needed to keep doing what I was doing and doing more of that.
It's crazy that you set yourself a bar of 20 books and then you smashed it within the first day. That must have given you some real confidence with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good. Like for me, I had an incredible opportunity in front of me that I had a partner in my life who was supportive enough of my goals that I could take an entire year off of work and then everything that's ever come after that too. And every day I was in at my desk at 7 a.m. and there for sometimes 12 hours. And I always have to keep telling myself that like, I'm not here to waste my partner's time. I'm not here to not make the most of this. So when I was presented with that kind of scary situation where I needed to move books, I didn't give myself the opportunity to fail. Like I just jumped in, you know, with both feet and did everything I could to make it happen. That's just, you know, comics is a tough industry to get into and it's a tough industry to become relevant in, and you have to grind and grind and grind. And like, I'm really committed to doing that because this is what I want to do with my life. And if I don't bust my ass, like it's not going to happen.
Of course. Being an anthology book, you worked with many artists and colorists to bring it to life. Was it difficult to keep track of what was going on, or was it pretty linear? So you worked with one set of creatives to produce one story and then moved on to the next?
Yes and no. So the first story I ever wrote, I wrote the script for a short story called Embrace. It's the story, it's just a drama story about a father and his autistic son and sort of how hard a day in their life can be and how they kind of navigate living with one another. I wrote that in April and I found the artist, Nanad Svitachanin, and the colorist, Esther Pimentel, and the letterer, Sean Reinhardt, who is still the letterer I collaborate with to this day. And for me, that first year was very, my approach was like going into the gym. So if my goal was to get on the bench press and bench press 300 pounds, you know, I had to start with a lighter weight, right? You know, you start with the bar and then you add 10 pounds and you add 20 pounds. And it was about putting in the reps and getting the practice and getting to a point where it was easy and then taking the next step. So I started with the one short story, worked through the production process of getting finding an artist and having them pencil and ink it, and then having the colorist color it, and then having the letterer letter it. And then as time went on, I wrote a second story and went through the process again. And eventually I was able to be writing two stories at once, to switch back and forth between them and have two stories in production at the same time. And I think by the end of it, I think there were three or four stories simultaneously in production that I was managing at different phases toward the end of creating the book. And that kind of leveling up has continued to this day. Just this morning, I was looking at art for three different books that are in production, three miniseries, in addition to, you know, just reviewing all of my Edge of Darkness promo stuff. So like over the last 5 years, it's been just about constantly leveling up and adding more weight to the bar.
Wow. Okay. And from Grief, you then went on to Dead End Kids. That book was nominated for, it won Best Writer as well as New Series. Was the feeling the same when you won awards, or was the feeling heightened by that?
It's definitely an honor to be nominated for an award, and it's definitely an honor to win an award. I think the gap between those two things for me isn't that big. Like the gap from not being nominated to being nominated is a huge jump, and then winning is just a little bit above that for me. It's like I said, it's an honor. It's not something I want to chase after necessarily. That's not why I make comics. I make it so that way I can get these stories out into the world for people to read. But it was absolutely cool to in the same year for the same book, which was my first miniseries, have somebody say, you are the best new writer. You are the writer of the best new series. It's a feather in my cap, but it's also not the driving force behind why I do this, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Did that open any more doors to you winning awards, or was the pacing still the same in terms of doing your own thing?
I don't know that the award itself moved the needle a whole lot. It's in my bio whenever I have to share a bio for an interview. So like it definitely looks good when people read it. I would say that Dead End Kids as a series really opened a lot of doors. So Dead End Kids is it's a late 90s murder mystery. It's a coming of age book. So it's kind of like the movie Stand By Me meets the Hardy Boys series of novels. A little darker, a little more violent. And it's got a murder mystery aspect to it, but it's very much the story about these kids who all come from these really tragic and broken homes, and how they find each other and take care of each other, and kind of what happens to their group dynamic when one of them is murdered, kind of how it all falls apart. But Grief, the performance of Grief for what it was, you know, we talked about how anthologies underperform and that they're not exactly what the American comics market is looking for, did really well for Source Point Press. It's on its second printing, which is, I think, almost sold out at this point. It got nominated for the award. I went to about 20 cons in 2018 with Source Point and hand sold thousands of copies of that book. And that showed Source Point that I was serious about this, that I was here to do work, and that whatever book has my name on it, I'm gonna get behind and give it 110%. So I pitched them Dead End Kids when it was done. I wrote it. It went through the whole production cycle, and I had print ready copies of all the files for the book. And I went to Travis, who I mentioned earlier, and said, "Hey, I've got this book. It's done. Can we get it on the calendar? Can we get it on the schedule? And he was like, "Look, you're a hustler. You're a grinder. The book is done," which is a huge plus. Like, if you can ever bring a publisher a book that's finished versus one that's, you know, just a text on a page pitch, that's always a huge get. Yeah, and they moved on it really quick. I think it went immediately on the schedule. Like, a lot of times when you come to a publisher, it's sometimes a year or years wait. This, I want to say that it solicited a month or two after I brought it to them, like almost immediately. But you know, I put in the time and the effort and showed them that I was serious, and they took note of that, and that opened the door for Dead End Kids. So much so that when I pitched the next book, No Heroine, I didn't even have it written yet. I just said, "Hey, I have this idea for a book." And they were like, "If you make it, we'll publish it." And that's, you know, that's just, I don't know, it's what happens when you work hard, I guess. People trust you.
Talking about no heroin, it came out next in 2020, slap bang in the middle of the pandemic, which is unfortunate. Did it affect how the book was released or received by critics at all?
You know, I can't really speak to whether the critics liked it more or less because of all that. Maybe they were easier on it just because everyone was kind of being a little bit nicer, I like to think, while we were all suffering. It solicited in April of 2020, which was more or less like when the lockdowns had come mostly into effect here in the U.S. It was also the month that Diamond Distributors, who at that time distributed about 100% of the comics industry, shut down because, you know, lockdowns and shelter in place and social distancing rules, just a warehouse setting, you know, it wouldn't work. It was pretty terrifying at first, honestly. I was really excited about the book. It had been getting good advanced reviews, and then it solicited and nobody could go to their local comic shop and order it because comic shops are closed and the distributor wasn't distributing. So it was in limbo for a little bit, but things here in the US opened a little bit starting in the late June, early July, so much so that the mail was kind of back up and running and the distribution was back at some capacity and comic shops could at least be open for curbside pickup and stuff like that. So all told, there was a point where I was like, okay, this book isn't going to come out. Like it might not come out, like, cause the publisher might go under cause they can't make any profit. But things did kind of rebound enough, and the book ended up coming out 1 week later than it was solicited. So that was really great. Like that was such a blessing. And I honestly think if we're going to look at this and try and like do the glass half full look, silver lining, I think I use that time between when the book was solicited and when it was supposed to come out. I really used that time because I was at home, like everybody else. I was able to reach out to comic shops and see if, you know, I could do anything for them. Really, really build out that network. But coming from a place that isn't business-minded, just really a genuine concern. SourcePoint and I quietly fundraised something to the tune of $10,000 so that way we could take that much of our stock and just give it to shops so they would have something to sell. While distribution was down, there were no new books coming in, but they were open. So, you know, that helped me connect with these shops too. When No Heroin was about to release, we did a retailer relief variant cover for it that I paid for out of pocket to have printed and drawn and sent to, I think, 50 comic shops that I was connected with so that they could sell it, you know, just and make a profit off of it. So like I don't know how to sit still, especially like in a bad situation. Like I have a natural urge to try and fix things and find solutions. So in those early months of the pandemic, when I was watching comic shops, you know, this industry that I love, suffer, I was really gung-ho on finding ways to help them. And I think that reflected very well on me. It wasn't why I did it, but it certainly helped. And I think I was on a lot more comic shops radars by the time the order cutoff for No Heroin rolled around. So I think that in a weird way, the pandemic helped the book be more successful. At that time, it was my biggest creator-owned launch by a significant margin. The orders were fairly high, and it ended up going to a couple of printings for each issue. And like all around, the book was a big success, which still is very wild to me because there was a point where I thought for sure that the book was never going to come out.
It was such a scary time. You did a sequel to Dead End Kids, which was Suburban Job. Did you feel added pressure with that because the first book was received so well, or did you not really think about it?
I would definitely be lying if I said I didn't feel pressure. Originally, there wasn't going to be Dead End Kids 2. I never imagined it as any kind of series or you know, series of series. And for anyone who's read the first one, I don't want to spoil it, but the ending of it is fairly definitive. It would be very hard to go back and tell more stories with those characters without undercutting or you know, jumping through some narrative hoops to make it work. Right after the first issue of Dead End Kids, the first series came out, I remember being at a con with Travis McIntyre, the editor-in-chief at some point, and he said, this book's our biggest hit. Like, this is the biggest launch of a title we've ever had. And if you want to do another one of these, we will publish it. And he left it open-ended. He didn't tell me I should go write another one. He said, you know, if you want to do this. But the truth is, I didn't have an idea. Because I hadn't been thinking of it in terms of what would come next. So I lived with it for a little bit, the idea of doing more. And initially I was turned off to the idea. But you know, as 2018 kind of wound down and all the cons that I attended were kind of in my rear view, and I was able to relax a little bit when the holidays came around, I started thinking about, all right, well, what would a sequel look like? And two things kind of happened. The first was that I watched True Detective Season 3, which was excellent. I was a huge fan of the first one. I haven't seen the second series just because people told me that it wasn't that great. But I like Marshall Ali a lot, so I watched the third one. And I realized, you know, here's a crime show is using this sort of anthology series format where it's got the same name, but it's a different story this time around with new characters. And I was like, that's a pretty cool way to get in to doing another Dead End Kids. You know, Dead End Kids it's a crime book with children. Yeah, that's kind of like the core concept. We can do a different crime and a different set of kids and not have to worry about, you know, taking away from the ending of the first one, which I really cherish, and I didn't want to kind of step all over. Then it became about finding the right story. Like I said, the first book was a murder mystery, but it really was about sort of childhood trauma and kids taking care of one another. And I didn't want to just do that again. So I let a little more time pass and was still not sure I would do more. But then my wife and I, sometimes we have conversations that things just come up and you end up talking about them with people. And one thing that's come up a lot in mine and my relationship over the years is September 11th. I grew up on the East Coast and my wife grew up on the West Coast in San Francisco. Where I grew up, it was in New Jersey, and you could look across our bay and see lower Manhattan where the Twin Towers stood. So I remember, like, really vividly on September 11th going down to the beachfront in our town and looking across and seeing the smoke billow up. And it was a very visceral experience for me. Whereas my wife, who years younger than me, lived on the other side of the country, and her experience of it was through a very different lens. And so we would end up talking about it sometimes, and, you know, it's kind of talking about how different it was for each of us. And a conversation like that happened, I think it was around Christmas that in 2018, we had that conversation. And then I realized that's something that affected me very, very profoundly. And also my wife, even though she didn't experience it how I did, very profoundly. And then I started thinking, you know, it's affected everyone in our generation, you know, every millennial. And then honestly, everyone who's ever come after us too, right? Gen Z kids have only ever lived in a post 9/11 world, right? Like, and that means something. All the laws that have been legislated since they've been born affect how their lives are. And it just kind of occurred to me that this is like a giant childhood trauma on a national or even international scale. And I very quickly began to realize that is something that I was interested in talking about, because there have been a handful of movies and books and TV shows that have kind of dealt with 9/11, but none to my knowledge that really look at it from, you know, how it impacted an entire generation of kids. And that just really fit well with the Dead End Kids kind of take on a story. So I kind of, between that and realizing the True Detective format, like, made sense, the wheels in my head started to spin, and I started figuring out who the characters were. Somewhere along the way, I realized it's going to be a heist book instead of a murder mystery, just so we weren't doing the same thing over again. This book is about a group of kids who have fallen out. So it's almost like the reverse of the first book. These kids aren't close and they're brought back together, and, you know, the relationships are tested in a different way. But the one thing that I really wanted to make sure stayed true when I was writing the book is I didn't want to write a 9/11 book. I didn't want to write about that. I wanted to write about what that day did to these kids. So the book takes place in 2008, so 7 years later. Each of the cast members is affected in a different way. The main character the daughter of a first responder who died at Ground Zero on September 12th. Another one of the characters, Brian, is the brother of a woman who fought in Afghanistan with the U.S. Army and died. And then the third lead character, Amna, is a young woman of Middle Eastern descent living in a post 9/11 U.S. And just I was just really interested in exploring these really different characters from the first cast and under these circumstances, but again, not telling a story about 9/11, but about how it impacted these kids, and you know, really kind of exploring that idea that the first Dead End Kids quite asked, that you know, does the terrible stuff that happens to you as a child have to determine who you end up becoming?
Right, next up is why we're here, which is Power Rangers Edge of Darkness. So if you haven't read the book, I would imagine there will be spoilers.
Yeah.
So you've said previously many times, and if people watch you on YouTube at Comic Book Food Chain, they'll know that you're a huge Power Rangers fan. You mentioned this just briefly in a previous question, but how did you get the Edge of Darkness opportunity?
Networking and a little bit of luck is like the short answer. The truth is, and I don't know how much people realize this about comics, but I can make any book I want. As a creator-owned book, I can do 50 volumes of Dead End Kids if I want to pay for it, and I have those stories to tell. I have, you know, carte blanche to do whatever I want with creator-owned stuff. But, you know, getting a gig doing Spider-Man or Superman or Power Rangers or whatever intellectual property is owned by somebody else is, you have almost no influence over whether or not you get those opportunities. That's somebody else has to say yes to that, and usually somebody else's multiple have to say yes for somebody to get that kind of job. So I knew that I would like to write Power Rangers. It's, if not my most favorite franchise, it's definitely one of the top things that has influenced me and entertained me over the years. That, you know, right behind me, you can't see this because we're recording, but I've got all the Zeo Megazords displayed on my bookshelf and all the Lightning Collection figures right under them. Like, I mean, I'm a big fan. But, you know, and I figured I can't say yes to this, but I can campaign to some extent. Like, I can do what I can to get on the radars of the people who say yes. So I cold emailed Daphna Plevin about 3 years ago, I want to say, maybe a little longer ago than that. And just said, hey, I'm Frank Gogol. I write comics. I had a series come out this year, Dead End Kids, that was pretty well received. I'm also a huge Rangers fan, and I'd love to talk about any opportunities you might have. And that email, for a very long time, went unanswered, which is just the reality of comics. Editors are very busy, and they don't have time to answer every cold email from somebody they don't know that crosses their desk. And I understood that, so I didn't follow up all the time. But every few months, when I had something new to say, you know, when No Heroine was announced, I sent Daphne an email. I said, "Hey, hope all's well. I've got this new book that just came out, also well received. Still super interested in working with you on some Power Rangers if the opportunity exists." And in addition to that, I travel to a lot of conventions, especially the bigger ones like New York Comic Con and San Diego Comic Con. And anytime I knew that Daphna or the assistant editor on Power Rangers, Gwen Waller, would be around, I made it a point to pop by the booth and just say hello, just remind them that I exist. You know, it didn't take up too much of their time, but said hello, and you know, how's it going? Here's what I've been up to. Love the books, would love the chat. And that's honestly about as much as you can do. All right, just get on their radar, make the best books you can, and that's your calling card. I honestly didn't think I'd ever get the shot, just because, you know, it's a 1 in 7 billion chance, right? Like, the comics industry isn't that big, but it's astronomical that the opportunity is going to be yours versus any of the other hundreds of writers in the comic industry. So I actually went ahead and wrote a Power Rangers-esque book, sort of Power Rangers meets the movie Alien. And that's actually soliciting right now. It's Born. So anyone listening wants to check that out, that's up for pre-order right now. As soon as I had finished writing that book and it had gone into production with the artist, last November I got an email from Daphna saying, "Hey, we're doing a Phantom Ranger book. Are you interested in writing it?" And I very calmly emailed her back and said, "Yes, of course. I'd love to chat." And while on the inside, I was doing backflips. Yeah, so that's kind of how the opportunity came about. Like, it was some part campaigning and making sure that Daphne knew who I was, and some part making sure my career was as successful as it could be, making the best books I could and making sure people were reading them, and then some bit luck that saw a tweet and thought of me when she knew that she had this opportunity, or however it came about. It's just, it's wild to me. Like, something cosmic happened and I don't know what it was. So that was very cool. And another really cool thing about the opportunity is when you're a young writer, when you're first doing your first work for hire work for Marvel or Boom or DC or wherever, you're usually competing against other young writers. They'll do what's called a bake-off, where several people will pitch for the same book and somebody will be the person chosen. Where with this opportunity, Boom came to me and said, "Hey, we want you for this book. Are you interested?" So like, it was, that was a very cool thing. Like, they just, you know, a little confidence.
I'd imagine they would give you a Bible to look at. Being such a huge Power Rangers fan, did you actually look at it at all while you were writing?
So a couple things. There was an email exchange with the offer to have a conversation, sort of with the suggestion that the book was mine if I was interested. And then I responded to that. And then the follow-up email was to set up a Zoom call to meet virtually, since we couldn't in person because of the pandemic, to talk about the opportunity and maybe spitball some ideas. And I think there was about a week or a weekend, a short amount of time between those. During that time, I went back and I watched all 10 episodes of Power Rangers that the Phantom Ranger is in, the 7 from Turbo and the 3 from Power Rangers in Space. And I also went back and reread every single issue of the Boom comics. At that point, I think Mighty Morphin number 55 had come out, and up through Go-Go 32 had come out. So I read, you know, probably about 90 comics over the course of a weekend. So I did a little preparing myself. In terms of what Boom gave to me, they essentially gave me all of that. They gave me a Google Drive folder that had PDF copies of every single issue that I had read, as well as the OGNs, you know, the Soul of the Dragon, the other two, Psychopath and Sins of the Future. So all that was in there. But they also gave me scripts, art, plot outlines for everything, basically up through what came out this week, everything up to Power Rangers number 8, or last week, I guess. So I got to see the script for Heir to Darkness. And throughout the whole process, I was able to see the art as it was coming in and the colors and seeing like the project evolve. I've known the plans for Mighty Morphin and Power Rangers since back in November, up through everything that's been published so far. So they gave me a lot to work with. Yeah, they were very generous with giving me resources to make this the best comic that I can and make it the best Power Rangers comic it could be.
While this story can be read on its own and can be understandable for completely new readers, it ultimately fits into a larger story. How much free rein were you allowed to have with it?
I don't remember anyone ever telling me no. No, that's not to say that like restrictions weren't in place. Like, you know, I they weren't going to let me kill Phantom Ranger, and I knew that. And there are things I knew they wouldn't let me do, so I never kind of pitched those ideas. But like, I remember those early conversations being really organic and open, and they really did. It felt throughout the whole thing, let me go in and tell the story I was interested in telling, with a very little hand holding. I remember all of the conversations being additive, and Daphne in particular, you know, really just helping me find ways to amp up the story and to tell it the best we could. I think there were some things that were asked of me that make a lot of sense. Initially, the pitch wasn't connected to the events of the end of Power Rangers number 8, but you know, in talking with Daphne, we realized, you know, we did want to give this some connective tissue to the larger Power Rangers comic universe and like what was going on, just to make it timely and relevant and to fit with the publishing schedule. You know, it comes out a week after Power Rangers number 8. So we said, you know, there's a really organic way to tie these together. Let's do it. Like, let's you know, let them play off of one another. At the same time, the story idea that we ultimately came up with, that after the opening scene of Go-Go Power Rangers number 19, when you see Fianna fight the Tangas with Child Rita, that there's more story after that, and that the Phantom Ranger is part of that story. We figured let's give it like a really tangible, recognizable link to that story, so it's clear to the reader that, you know, this is picking that up. But like aside from that, everything else really came from me and conversations with Daphna. You know, the sort of core concept for the story, that the, you know, the Phantom Ranger is on a secret mission for Zordon to rescue Fianna and baby Rita or toddler Rita, came from me kind of thinking on the Phantom Ranger and everything I know about. I'm a big fan of the fan theories. Some of them don't work, and they never did. Some of them are really interesting, and it would be cool to see them play out. But just for the purposes of creating a character in the comics that has a lot of runway to tell more stories, looking forward and looking backward, you know, giving them a backstory even, we decided to go the route we went, and looking at everything we did know about the Phantom Ranger, which honestly, watching those 10 episodes he shows up in, is next to nothing. Very underdefined character, which, you know, was kind of the point, right? They wanted it to be a mystery, but by virtue of it being a mystery, we don't know anything. So there was a lot of canvas there to create something new, but I did want to make it, you know, recognizably similar to what we did know. And the thing that stood out to me most, Phantom Ranger in both Turbo and in Space, aside from the episode where he loses his ruby, and you know, that's the arc of those, I think it's two episodes. The only other major thing he does is deliver Megazords, right? In Turbo, he delivers the rescue Megazord. And then in Space, he's the one who gives them the coordinates of the Delta Megazord, I think. So, like, in my mind, I was like, all right, so this guy is, he's the Jason Statham of the Power Rangers universe. He's the transporter, right? He delivers things. So like, that was kind of like the nugget of the idea, the kernel, the idea that led to, okay, so he's running missions for Zordon, and he's got to deliver these two characters. And that's just kind of where it came from, and everything else came out of it organically. The goal of the book was to introduce Phantom Ranger in a really, really big way and set him up for lots and lots of stories, you know, and give, but, and also, you know, add to the mystery. We agreed early on that we weren't going to take off the helmet in this, because once you take off the helmet, the character stops being interesting, right? I'm not saying it'll never happen. I don't know when it'll happen, but like, once you take off the helmet and it's Billy or it's whoever, then it stops being interesting. Like, the mystery is what makes it interesting. Like, I look at a character like Wolverine, who had no memory in the X-Men comics for decades. And then in the 2000s, they gave him his memories back, and he like immediately became less interesting to me. You know, we wanted to kind of play with the mystery, add like setting the book 10,000 years before the present, you know, that we know him in, like, immediately raises a whole bunch of questions. Like, you know, how old is this guy? How long has he been doing this? How long has he been working with Zordon? You know, and so on and so forth. What other characters is he connected to? He's connected to Rita, like in this very significant way. So it was about doing that and peppering in other things, you know, tying him to the Morphin Grid, really making him larger than life in a way that the so it's, I'm not even sure the question you asked me anymore. I just started talking.
I love hearing when people just sort of carry on, and then by the end of it they don't know what I've asked. But it's, I love hearing your thoughts. We learn a little bit more about Rita and her family, as well as how they fit into the larger Power Rangers universe. With it being smaller than a graphic novel but larger than a standard comic, did you have trouble cramming it all in, or were there storylines that were cut out?
I want to say that this is fairly intact from the initial pitch. If anything, it it grew a little bit. We might have added a scene or kind of like emotional beats that weren't in the initial pitch, but it definitely didn't. Nothing was cut. I tend to approach things pretty practically, and my approach to most things is, if you have a big project, break it into smaller bite-sized pieces, right? When I'm writing a 20-page script, I say, all right, if I write 3 pages a day for a week, I'll be done, right? Like, and that's kind of my approach to everything. So when I said, or when I knew I had 40 pages, all right, I was like, well, that's just two issues of a comic, right? A comic is 20 or 22 pages. That's just two comics. So when I was breaking down the plot, I essentially planned it as a two-part story that just didn't have a month between issues. So the first half of the book is the rescue mission on Dakar, where we meet Phantom Ranger and we catch up with him, and he saves Rita and Fianna. He's hurt, and the cliffhanger there is they have to save him, right? And then the second half of the next 20 pages is everything on the Master Forge leading to the climax of the book. And that's probably, hopefully not super obvious, two, you know, very distinct parts, but that's kind of how I approached it.
And I've got one question about Rita's family, because we see the mother, the father, but where's the brother?
That's a good question. It's a very good question.
I think in the Boom comics he's only appeared, I think, once, and that's in the Power Rangers Pink series, if I'm not mistaken. He appears on like variant covers and stuff, but I mean in the actual story, I'm pretty sure it's only in Power Rangers Pink, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Are there any other properties that you would love to write for?
You know, the funniest thing, back in November, like days, if not even the day I got the email asking if I was interested in doing a Rangers book, I put together a little graphic that I shared on social media, and it was just kind of what my dream jobs would be. Like the four properties that, you know, if I could write them, it would be bucket list items. And on that list was Power Rangers. That was the number one thing, which just, again, like I said, something cosmic happened. I don't know what it was, but it's blows me away. Also on that list was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which, huge part of my childhood, one of the most influential things on me wanting to be a writer. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, grew up on the Turtles, loved the Turtle. And then Beast Wars, which, interestingly enough, is now a comic again. So it's just, like I said, I just put that graphic together, and I wanted to put it out into the universe. You know, just, I'm a big believer in making declarations about the things you want, what your goals are. And it just, so far, it's worked out.
Buffy is weird for me because I remember watching it growing up, but I don't remember anything from it at all. But I remember being really into it when I was about like 3 years old. Mm-hmm. I definitely was not the demographic for it, but I absolutely loved it. And then I read the Boom comics for that up until the first. I don't know if they've done any more since, but the first event, I can't remember what it was called. But I just didn't, because my comic book shop forgot an issue, they didn't order an issue, or something happened, I didn't get the third issue of Angel, I think. So I really like dropped off that series, but I need to pick that back up because I was enjoying it. And so I need to get back on that grind. And TMNT is an absolute classic. So all of your choices there are definitely valid, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, I like to think so. And Beast Wars, I'm telling you, it's going to make a comeback. It's been 24 years since it premiered. Next year is the 25th anniversary. I know that the next Transformers movie is going to be Beast Wars-esque. I think there are plans there. So yeah. I'm trying to get in on the ground floor.
I'm looking forward to that film with caution. It's... because when I read about the film and what they're planning, I thought surely that's too much for 2 hours. You're introducing so many characters. But hey, if it works, and it'll be great. But if it doesn't, then they may leave a bad taste in people's mouths for Beast Wars stuff, which I'm hoping isn't the case. It's always a worry.
Yeah, I go into the Transformers movies just with very low expectations. Not that I think they'll be bad, but like this is the seventh one. I know what they're going to be at this point. If I walk out of those theaters after seeing those movies and am disappointed, that's my fault. the other thing is that because my brain is a writer's brain, like it's very hard for me to watch most things and not sit there and analyze it and pick it apart and try to figure out how something they did that I liked worked, or something that I didn't like, you know, what went wrong, and like, you know, kind of pick up tools as I watch things. But the Transformers movies, for some reason, I could just watch them and not have to worry about how they were. Something about them just says, don't study me.
A bit like the Fast and Furious series, which is a weird series for me because I will put up with the Transformers series, but I just can't stand the Fast and Furious series. But they both sit in the same avenue of we're ridiculous and you'll either love us or hate us.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's a bit like that for me. Being a Lightning Collection fan, what is your most wanted figure?
I'm a little biased, I'll admit on this, but Phantom Ranger is obviously going to be a big one for me. We, you know, thank you to the Twitter sleuths who uncovered the secret listing for the Phantom Ranger in Wave 10. I don't want to take credit for that. I don't think that I made that happen, but if anyone wants to give me credit for that, I'm surely willing to take it.
it's mad what Josh will find on the internet. I don't know how he has the time, because he works night shifts, and then during the day, he does Lightning Collection videos somehow.
Yeah. He's just incredible. There are a couple others that I would like to see. Time Force Pink, Jen, is one of my favorite characters, which doesn't make me special in any way. I know that Super Mega Force isn't the most beloved season, but I love those costumes because I love pirates. And Gia is such a great character, so Super Mega Force Yellow would be just awesome to have. I'm sure there are others that are slipping my mind right now. I love all of the Draken series. I know we're getting the Red Tyranno Sentry from Target, or at least we are here in the States. Good luck with that. But the Mastodon Trooper, the Sabertooth Tiger Trooper, even the blue, was it Samurai Trooper that was in Shattered Grid, or maybe it was Ninja Steel, I can't remember. But like, I just love all those kind of like alt universe takes on them. Like, you know, I don't need a cell shaded Pink Ranger, but give me like a Ranger Slayer any day of the week if you want to reuse those parts.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to those figures as well. When they do come out, when they come out, which I would imagine they'll spread them out throughout the year or years even. Looking forward to those.
I'm also very much looking forward to the COGs. Like I said earlier, I have all those Zeo Megazords displayed. Zeo's my favorite season, and I love the COGs. And I love that they did a two pack of them, and that they're two different COGs, like with the head that has the face up and everything. It's just very excited for those.
Yeah, they look to be really nice. And I'm really happy that they're doing grunts in the line. Because that was a genuine worry when they started. I was like, are we actually going to be able to get grunts? But they've already come out with three in 3 years, which I think is pretty good going. The parties in the first year, and then Tengas and Cogs in the third year, and you could even say the Z parties in the second year. So really four. But I'm loving the amount of grunts that are coming out.
I'm very excited. I haven't gotten a Tenga yet. I've got a handful of them on order. Whenever Hasbro ships those out, I'll get those. But you know, since they play such a big part in Edge of Darkness, I'm excited to get my hands on those as well. And I'm looking into some customizers to maybe make the special Tenga from Edge of Darkness, the priest.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up. The priest, is that a? I'll be completely honest, I've not watched all of Power Rangers, so please do forgive me. And season 3 is a real blind spot for me. Is that character established, or did you create that character?
Tenga Priest is an original creation for the book. I wanted to make sure that I put one original character in there, so that way I could, you know, have some ownership of something. Not ownership, but like, you know, bragging rights.
You added something to the lore that is
exactly.
I mean, you've added something to the lore, but you've added a character to
exactly.
the lore.
But I also wanted to make him like really, really different than the Tangas we've seen. So he's, you know, one of the goals with the Edge of Darkness, you know, at a very high level was to be additive, right? I wanted to add concepts about the grid. I wanted to give Master Vile a backstory. I wanted to establish the Master Forges, this you know, series of space stations scattered throughout the universe that belong to the Morphin Masters. I wanted to touch lots of corners and add little new wrinkles to the tapestry of Power Rangers. And the idea that there's a sect of Tangas out there that are cult-like and worship Master or Dark Spectre beyond just being disposable foot soldiers was like really, really cool to me. But I also wanted to like give like a real big physical threat to Phantom Ranger in the book. So creating this priest who bites into this gnarly looking egg and hulks out and just is absolutely ferocious, but also weirdly religious. Like, what a great character. If I could pat myself on the back a little bit, but like, that's a weird, cool character. I would love to see a Lightning Collection version of that character. It's a little obscure and brand new, so I don't know what the odds are. But you know, like I said, I'm looking for a customizer maybe to create one for me just in case.
I think they could make it work because they've made a brand new sculpt with the Tenga, and it'll be retooling. I don't think it'll be necessarily a brand new sculpt, but I think retooling wise, I think they can make it work, definitely.
Oh, yeah. And I think that the Hulk body from the Hulk and Wolverine first appearance Marvel Legends pack that came out 2 years ago would be a pretty good base for the Brawler version, if anyone wanted to take it. Anyone listening wants to take it.
it would be a pretty cool two-pack to have the priest in both sort of like a non-monster form and then, well, a Hulk out form, as you pointed out. So I think that would be a really cool two-pack. Whether they'll do it or not, or whether they'll separate them into different two-packs, they'll probably do that because they seem to like doing the whole, you'll have a brand new character and then a retool or a re-release of another character for a two-pack.
Has Hasbro's a business. If they can resell you the same toy without having to make a new one, totally get it. Is it annoying? Yeah, but I get it.
People feel very strongly about it. I mean, I'm in your band where I'm like, I'm fine with it.
Sure. Well, I also recognize that, you know, not everybody has the disposable income to buy a second Yellow Ranger just because it has Aisha's head, right? And honestly, my preference would be for everything to be in single packs. I'm an inbox collector, and I display on a shelf with the side artwork showing. So like, you know, my InSpace blue when it comes is not going to be able to fit on the shelf with my InSpace yellow that's there, like, because it's going to be a different box artwork, it's going to be a different size, and then if I display it that way, Psycho Silver won't. So I get, you know, it, I have a privileged frustration about it, but you know, I do get where the people who don't want, I don't like two packs either, but I accept them because it is what it is. Nothing I can do to change it.
Me and Josh were talking about how we would sort that situation out, because it is frustrating when, like you said, like, you've got a line of portraits and they look really good, and then a two-pack comes along and it really breaks it all up, because you can either have one side facing outwards but then you're missing the other side, or you have to have the figures face on, and in my mind it's not as appealing as when they're all lined up on the sides or to the sides. So it's a real problem, and I think for future, maybe they could do something like the Putty 2-pack, where the artwork is on pretty much every side.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a piece of art on both sides. Nothing's really missing on the front or to the sides. Everything's always shown. So I think that could be a place where they, a thing they could do to sort that issue out. But again, like, it's privilege. It's not something that is detrimental to collecting at all. It's just something that's mildly irritating. So
I think at this point, honestly, just because as comfortable as I am buying a second Yellow Ranger that comes with Aisha's head and a new Scorpina figure, like, I think the two packs aren't going away, and that some of the key characters are going to be collected only in the two pack format. So I'll probably transition soon to being an out of box collector, which is too bad, but it is what it is. At the end of the day, I don't wake up every morning and worry about my Lightning Collection figure that much. I don't know. I'm just a practical person, I guess.
If Boom came to you and asked you, I don't know if you can talk about this at all, because I know with authors and creators in general, you can't really talk about what you'd hope to do just in case one day it actually comes to fruition. But if Boom came up to you and asked you to write an OGN or an original graphic novel, what series would you tackle? If you could tackle anything in the whole series, what would you tackle?
That's a good question, and I'm honestly not sure what the answer is. Like, I would rather see new Power Rangers content created than revisit old seasons. There are some seasons I truly, truly love. Zeo is my favorite. Huge Time Force. I mean, like, and obvious. But those stories were told, and like, they, for the most part, they're really satisfyingly told. And it feels like to dig back into them is just takes away from them. Sort of like the how I felt about writing a second Dead End Kids. Like, if you do more, it takes away sometimes. Like, unless you hit a home run, but you always run the risk. So like, you know, I. If Boom would be up for it, I would love to do an OGN or you know, an ongoing series that establishes a new team. Like, I love what Ryan's doing with the Omega Rangers. I found such a cool way to bring Jason, Zach, and Trini back into the fold, and it kind of makes sense. But, like, you know, there's so much more storytelling opportunity when you get to create a new cast of villains and a new set of powers and a new little sandbox to exist in. If somebody put a gun to my head and said, pick a team, probably RPM. Just because that one's in its own universe, and you know, you don't have to worry too much about 30 years of continuity. You just have to worry about one season of continuity. And from a writer, that seems a little more digestible. And I feel like we didn't get enough Flynn.
Right. I've seen parts of RPM. I haven't seen the whole series. I should probably do that because people do rave about it a lot.
Yeah. I just think what's cool about it is, like, it is self-contained in that it is in its own universe. And there is a story that suggests itself after, right? You've survived the apocalypse. The evil is gone. What does rebuilding the world look like? Whereas most other Power Rangers series wrap up and, you know, you go back to what it was like before the monsters attacked, right? Like, you know, Rita gets out of the dumpster, changes how things are, and then Rita is defeated and things are quiet again in Angel. Whereas the RPM universe, clear, interesting next chapter after Vengex falls. But that's just me. Like, I'll read anything that they make. Like, if they do I don't love Operation Overdrive. I think it's my least favorite season. But if they did an Operation Overdrive GN, I would read. Also, if Boom's gonna offer me more work, I'll write what they ask me to. Like, I'm not picky.
that's understandable. Right, and my last question is, where can people find
you? As for where people can find me, the most important free way you can support a creator is by getting on their mailing list. If you like Edge of Darkness, or you check out any of my other, you know, what I'm doing, and you want to keep up with me and you know about what I'm doing, I do a mailing list, caption box. It's a newsletter that goes out twice a month. You can sign up for it on my Twitter, the Instagram, it on Facebook a lot. There are lots. It's also my website. If you go to frankogle.com, it's on every single page, subscription, little pop-up. But yeah, that's by far the best way. Newsletters aren't your thing. Like, I'm on Twitter, it's at Frank Ogle. I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/Frank Ogle. I got in early and got all the URLs and usernames. Thank God. Makes things easier. But yeah, any of those. Awesome. I also am one of the hosts of a comic book YouTube show called Comic Book Food Chain. It's a panel style show with a retailer, book collector, and a creator myself. And we sort of podcast style discuss lots of different topics around the comic industry. And we have guests on, and we do fun segments that are kind of like game show games. Like, it's my way to relax every week. I throw hard on comics, and then once a week I get to hang out with my friends, and talk about comics, and have a good time. And it's a good time. We're coming up on 1,000 subscribers over there. So that's, if you like YouTube stuff, you can go check out Comic Book Food Chain and subscribe to the channel. So lots of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming on, Frank. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And I just want to say thank you to Frankie Waters for putting together the intro and outro. You can find him at figure_lens on Instagram. And also thank you to Josh Steele for putting together the cover art. You can find him at A Basket of Kisses on Instagram, or his website is joshsteele.co.uk. And if you want to support me, you can find me on Instagram at Lightning Collection or on Twitter at PRL Collective. I've also got a YouTube channel and I've got a video that would have gone up last week by the time you listen to this. And also I've set up a Ko-fi as well, which is sort of, because I know that a few of you guys have wanted to support me in other ways rather than just listening. So I've set up one of those as well. I'll link that down below. By no means, you don't have to do anything with that, but it is there if you want to. So yeah, have a good week and I'll speak to you guys soon. Bye.
Bye.
You've just been listening to the Lightning Collective podcast. Have a great day.